I want to send out a special thanks to the sponsors of today's show, William, Josie the Mountain Troll, and Panther. Thank you so much. We humbly and truly could not do this show without you.
Southern Bramble is a Patreon-supported podcast. If you would like to support the podcast and gain access to early, unedited video footage, listener questions, or be thanked by name, you can find us at patreon.com/southernbramble.
You're listening to Southern Bramble, a podcast of crooked ways. I'm Marshall, the Witch of Southern Light.
And I'm Austin, Bane X Bramble on Instagram. And today we have with us a very special guest. Please welcome Devin Forrest. Devin, how are you today?
I am fantastic. And I'm so excited and also terrified to be with you both right now. I feel like I'm at the High Council and I need to be like bowing down to both.
Oh, God, no.
Jeez.
Please.
I know you both probably hate to hear that, but that's what it feels like on this end.
I don't hate to hear it. More so as like, oh, you never should place that much perceived importance. I'm like, oh no, I'm.
I may be on my soapbox sometimes, but the pedestal is super short.
Hey, the shorter the pedestal is, the harder there it is to knock you off them. So
that's right. No, that's so true, because you know we've seen some fall.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways. I'm really excited to have you on here. I've been following you for several years now. I love your work. If anyone isn't following Devin on Instagram or on social media, his Instagram is Dev Forst, F-O-R-S-T. You've got to follow him immediately. Pull over if you're driving and follow right away. The art is stunning. Literally, it's, and I feel like, maybe it's just me, I think we've actually had this conversation privately before, I feel like I'm super, super drawn to your art because I feel like you and I have sometimes very similar visions of like spirit ideas and concepts. I feel like we have just very, very similar love of folklore and a forked staff and a windy night and soul flight. I feel like there's just something there that I am so, so drawn to your art. It just is just like, literally, if you don't know the art, you've got to go see it.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for those kind words. I really appreciate it. But I also agree. I think we do have a lot of intermingling interests in that area. And I think it's so, I love it. And it's also so strange to me that when I go to my Instagram following, like half is other artists and the other half is all magic and witchcraft practitioners, which is, so, I'm so honored that all those kinds of people seem to find some sort of connection in my art. So I love that I get to connect with people in that way.
Absolutely.
I was wondering, because of your love, like scrolling through some of your work, I know that there's such an influence of pop culture, but the things that always, or like horror culture, I should say, and some of the things that really I noticed the most though, has a lot to do with, like I've seen like images of the witch or things that are very inspired by like Robert Eggers movies, or even like the Sanderson sisters and things like that. And so to me, there's this very almost Sleepy Hollow-esque touch to your work. And I was wondering if you could tell us, like, where did you grow up? Like, did you, I think you mentioned that there was some sort of Atlantic Gate connection that you had there. Where did you grow up? And do you call yourself a witch? And yeah, tell us about your childhood trauma.
For sure. I mean, that was actually a perfect segue with you saying like Sleepy Hollow-esque things, because I do live in Pennsylvania. I was born and raised here. But I know Sleepy Hollow is not here, but it's in the Northeast. So I feel like everything that I do and my
art. Top of the jump.
Yeah, my art has a lot of Northeastern influences. I just love the aesthetic of like Salem, Sleepy Hollow, weird forests in autumn. That's really my kind of vibe. But yeah, I grew up in Pennsylvania. I lived for most of my youth in central Pennsylvania. So it's pretty much the middle of nowhere, like Hicktown. No one ever knows where it is when I talk about it. But for the past, I guess it's almost a decade now, this year, I've lived in Lancaster. So it's like the southern, easternmost part of Pennsylvania. And I like it here a lot more. And I wouldn't mind staying here and not going back to central Pennsylvania if I could help it. But yeah, I was also raised Catholic, which I think is that's a pretty common pipeline from Catholicism into like witchcraft, magical practices, things of that nature. I know a lot of people that talk about witchcraft practices kind of knew when they were younger that it was something they were going to get into. They've read the books on Wicca, things of that nature. I didn't really have that experience when I was younger, but one pivotal moment that I talk about all the time when I think about it is my grandma used to work next to the local library, and I would go visit her at work a lot of the time. So I would just pop on over to the library as a kid and just pick out random books, sit down and read them. And I don't remember what the book was, what it was called, but I was just looking at it, and there was like a 2 or 3 page section on the Salem witch trials. And for some reason, up to that point, I was so young, I had never really heard of them before. And I read through the whole thing, and they had like old paintings and like woodcuts and things of that nature. And I was like, holy shit, I didn't know that witches were real, that they actually existed. I thought they were just in movies and video games that I had watched. So that kind of blew my mind when I was little. And I was always interested in magic and mystery. Everything that I took in was a fantasy film or a game or a book. So, although I grew up Catholic and I was religious for a lot of the time, so many of the things that I personally was into dealt so much with the occult and the opposite side of things that when I grew up and I left high school and was in college, I just sort of decided that religion wasn't really for me anymore. And that's sort of how I found the path that I'm on, I suppose, at this point, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Oh my, it's so funny you mentioned that. I remember being in like elementary school, and my town I grew up in had like it was like this elementary school different names, and then in the middle schools it was like Northeast and Southwest. It was like a really small town with lots of people, so a lot of multiple schools. But I remember like somehow in my little school, in all of the different schools, they had this one singular book, and it was like a book on, I think it was just called Witches, and it was like this brown. I almost want to say it was like one of those old books where it came in like a collection of different subjects of paranormal things, like ghosts, vampires, witches, all these things. But this one, it was just one of them. That was just the one. I guess it was donated to the school or something. I still remember it must be old because it smelled like I can still remember the smell of this book. You know, when pages start to age, they just get the binding. Maybe it's the glue in the binding or something like that. Like I'm talking about it and it's still so vivid, and I still remember talking about or reading about areas where it was like the history of Salem, the history of witch trials and the Inquisition over in Europe. And then there were pages on like, remember there was a whole section on Sibylique, which was my first. I have a memory of Sibylique all the way from elementary school. Now that I'm 37 years old, it was crazy. There was a whole page on Laurie Cabot, the official witch of Salem. So it must have come out sometime after the 80s. But it was just so memorial for me. Is that past tense of having memory? We'll make it today. It was very memorial to me, and it stuck with me. And I swear, I don't know what it is about witches and books, but like my mom was the type of mom who would drop me off at Barnes and Noble while she went shopping, and I would just peruse for hours. I could totally do that. But I have these memories of my literal local library in school having my first inspiration, and it stuck with me. And I don't even know where to find it. I would love to find it if I ever got the option. If I saw the cover, I would know exactly what it was.
Absolutely. And I think books are such an important part of just, I guess, life in general, but especially finding like a magical practice, especially through folklore, because I know some people, like you said, have an introduction to these sorts of things through like actual people who were alive or are still alive and were practicing and popular at that point. But I think the reason my art has sort of become the way that it has is because my introduction to these things was through folklore and mythology, not really through specific practitioners, but just hearing the stories and the myths that were told about these types of practices. It really just entered my brain and stuck there and transformed as I got older into what I create now.
I think that so many people have, or at least maybe not so many people, so many people that I think we encounter have this like pipeline of library book finding, stumbling across something. I mean, how many interviews have we done, Marshall, where we have people, it's like, oh, I stumbled into a library and found this really captivating book. For me, it was
Oils and Incense and Brews, wasn't it?
It was Incense, Oils, and Brews was like my first like real witchcraft book. And then there were other ones too. Like there was this, and I could not tell you what this was. I got it at the Collier County Public Library when I was a kid, but it was like a VHS tape that we had rented. Yes, it was about like, it was probably about like wizards and witches or something like that, but I remember watching it. And it was like a sh documentary kind of thing. I couldn't have been older than six, and watching it, and you know, it was all, it had a lot to do with the devil. And I remember watching it, and then my mom saw that what it was about. She thought she got it for me because she thought it would be like, oh, it's cute or whatever. And then she saw that, and she was like, oh no. So that was really fun. And also, speaking of Sleepy Hollow, Disney Legend of Sleepy Hollow is just an iconic film, forever embedded into my mind.
Absolutely. Did either of you ever see the? I think they had, it was like a double feature of like Mr. Toad and Sleepy Hollow that they had when we were
It's still on
younger.
Disney right now. You can literally
Okay,
watch it. It's
cool.
on Disney
It was
Plus.
always the strangest combination of things to me, but somehow
So
it also made
strange.
sense. And I had it on VHS when I was a kid and I watched it all the
I
time.
used to watch it, but I remember at the end of it, every time they switched to Mr. Toad, I'd shut it off. I'm like, I'm not interested. I've still never seen it. I have no idea what it's about. And I'm like, how did we go from nighttime, dark, spooky to this very sunny, picturesque scene? I was like, no. And then I would shut it off and I'm like, okay, I'm done. Or I just rewind it.
I was obsessed with the Legend of Sleepy Hollow, or just the Sleepy Hollow movie with Johnny Depp and Christina Ricci and Miranda. What was her name? Is it Miranda? I can't remember her name, who played like the wicked stepmother who was like evil. Like that whole, and Christopher Walken as the actual like headless horseman. That whole movie, the vibe of it, the creepiness, the Picketty Witch, the Picketty Witch. Who's got to kiss the Picketty Witch? Like I was obsessed with it. My mom even got me this big, huge tabletop book that was all about the making of, and it had like early sketches of the dresses that Katrina von Tessel was going to wear. And I didn't even know that it actually had a real history of a family that lived up in Sleepy Hollow. Like that there's a whole history behind this. It was a piece of oral folklore that got passed down, that Disney got the rights to. I mean, like, it's so crazy that we think of this as like a modern movie with Johnny Depp, but it actually had a serious history about a local town all the way up in like northeast New York.
New York, yeah. There is a Sleepy Hollow. Do you want to know a really interesting little 5-second fact about me?
Duh.
After doing some, I wish I could say that I still knew this person, but this somebody had done some ancestry, like ancestry.com. It was like a kind of a little passion project of hers, so she was doing it to me for free, and she actually found out that I'm related to the Van Jessels. So it's not Van Tessels, it's the Van Jessels, and they were Dutch. And they're the Van Jessels of Sleepy Hollow.
Wow. So
That's yeah.
so there were Van Tessels and Van Jessels.
Van Tessel is kind of like a
Like a
probably
reworking of
a
the name.
reworking of the name, because of to not sound so Dutch or something like that.
No, that's actually very true. I was looking the history of my legal last name, and it actually went through several iterations from a whole different coat of arms over in like Ireland. So that is very interesting to think about.
Yeah, 5-second facts. But again, we're not here to talk about me. Dev, you're a fantastic illustrator, and I'm very curious, how did you get into your art? Did you I always did you were you the kind of kid in school who would always be drawing instead of paying attention? Because that was me.
Oh, absolutely. And it feels like such a cliche answer every time someone asks this question. It's like, I've been doing it since I was a kid, but it's absolutely true. That's all I did when I was a kid. I did it at home, I did it in class, I did it in between classes. Like, I would go draw on the board at school, and people were always amazed at what I would draw. I would doodle in my notebook, and people would come watch me. And when I was in high school, I wasn't a popular kid, but I also wasn't like on one of the lowest tiers. I was just somewhere floating in the middle and didn't really have a place where I fit, but everyone was always really nice to me, I feel, because I was artistically inclined and could draw cool things, and they thought that was neat. So it's one of those things where, like, if you find something cool that you can do when you're like an adolescent, people suddenly accept you, even though they should be accepting in general. But I do feel like art really helped me to express myself a lot more when I was younger. And it kind of just evolved since I was a kid. I was drawing wizards. My uncle used to have old calendars from like Lord of the Rings that like the original artists who worked with Tolkien and things of that nature were making. So I would look at those images and I would try and copy them in my own little kid drawing sort of way. I have an old clipping that my mom has from a local newspaper that I sent in a picture of Gandalf that I'd drawn at like 8 years old that they put in the newspaper, which is so cool to see because it really shows the evolution of like, I was still working with the similar themes back when I was a kid, but it really evolved as I got older and matured a bit and learned more about like magical practices and forming my own practice. And now it's a lot more rooted in folklore and mythology than I guess I could get it when I was a child.
Oh no, that makes so much sense. It's so funny. I remember because I drew a lot when I was younger as well, and I had like all these sketchbooks, and I still have a whole bunch of them. And sometimes I take them out, and you can kind of like see the different like phases of when I was really into anime and everyone had huge anime eyes, or when I was really into like getting the actual anatomy more correct. And there was a lot of like kind of trying to, here is the picture, and I'm going to try to recreate it over here. And I always got it really off. But for some reason, when I look back at it now as an adult, I think the thing that I struggled with, like not getting it perfect when I was younger, and now I'm kind of like, oh, but I like it. Like I feel like there's so much more character to it, if that makes sense. And you do a lot of your art now digitally. Is it through Procreate?
Yes, that's how I do everything now. And I get a lot of messages because I do try and use a lot of more traditionally textured brushes. So they almost have, like, I drew it on a piece of paper itself. So I get a lot of messages like, what did you use to print this? Like, with a wood block, or like, what kind of pencils are you using? And I'm like, it's all digital. I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I'm glad that it comes across that way because that's the vibe I'm going for. And it's really like the ease of use that you get with an iPad and the portability that it has.
I'm wondering if you, this is a curveball question, which how do you feel? Do you feel like, or what would your response be, I guess, to the people who maybe have preconceived notions of like the idea that like digital art is cheating or is easier? And mind you, I prefer pen and ink because I have Procreate. It's a useful tool, especially for what I do if I want to like get rid of the backgrounds of certain things or even to digitize something and then remove my paper from it and then so I can use it digitally, which is where most of my stuff gets put on anyways. But let me tell you, as somebody who's tried to use Procreate, it is not easier. It is a pain in the ass, especially if you don't know what you're doing. And I did digital art for years in high school. I took 4 years of AP digital arts and was taking like college level Photoshop and Illustrator things. And I still am like, Procreate's difficult. I don't want to use it. How do you feel about that?
If I could go on a tangent just about like art school and art in general for 1 second. When
Please
I was
do.
in college, most of the stuff I did up until about maybe the end of junior year was entirely traditional. I was using watercolor, pen and ink. That was really the only thing I knew how to do. I had always drawn with pencils and colored pencils, but we had to take a mandatory digital art class in like mid junior year of college, and I was mortified. I had one of the like Wacom plug-in computer tablets for the longest time since I was like in high school. I had barely ever used it, but I still had it. So I used it for that class and we were doing paintings. Mine were always so terrible. I mean, looking back, just starting out, they weren't so bad, but at the time I was like, this is the worst thing that was ever been created. But since I had to take that class, I spent so much time just teaching myself how to get down like the hand-eye coordination of using a digital tablet. And I got pretty proficient at using Photoshop to paint. And then when I did my senior thesis the next year, I did it entirely in Photoshop, just drawing with the pad. And that's what I was using shortly after I graduated. And then I had a lot of graduation money, and I saw so many other artists that I was following were using an iPad Pro with Procreate. So I thought, well, since most of the stuff I'm doing now is digital and I like how easily portable it is, and I'm such an indecisive and anxious person, I can make so many changes digitally. I just splurged and got an iPad and Procreate, and that's what I've used for the past several years to make literally everything. So I don't really, I guess it's been a long time conversation. It's kind of fizzled out at this point whether or not digital mediums are cheating, so to speak, because I guess it is just another medium, but I feel like it's having another resurgence in the zeitgeist, especially with people using AI for a lot of stuff now, which I'm also on the fence about that. I do think there are a lot of ethical issues with it scraping people's work and filtering it in that way. But I also think it could be a really cool tool to use, especially as like a concept designer or to use for paintovers, or I don't know. It could be used in a great way. I don't think it's being used properly the way some people are using it, but it's an interesting conversation to have.
I think it's, yeah, I fully agree. I think there's a resurgence in the conversation with AI. And then I also saw somebody, it's like an ad that I keep seeing on my Instagram. Somebody has been making a tool that Renaissance painters used to use that was essentially a projection, like a projector, and classic artists would use it for paintings. But I remember reading the comments the first time I saw it, and people were like, oh, this is cheating. And it's like, do you not realize, like, these people were tracing, like, a lot of these people were tracing pictures, and yet Caravaggio loved this thing. It was like his most used tool to get his illustrations down before he would paint. And it's like, people were tracing pictures, mama. It really, it's fine. We've
It's been a
always
thing
used
forever.
it's yeah, we've always used tools to help. And so that was just an interesting little thing. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Of course. I think that about so many things. Like, so people so often just have arguments about, like, this makes doing this thing too easy, or this is cheating, you should do it the hard way. And I'm like, well, as humans, we are constantly making things so that we can do things more easily and more quickly. Sometimes it's not always used in the most ethical way, but if you're using it properly, I don't think there's anything wrong with using a tool to help you do something a little easier.
And it's always the people who have never picked up a pen or a brush. So,
Absolutely.
oh, true.
When I was in college, we had a whole little like dark side closet room that was just full of projectors that we would use, because we would make smaller sketches like in sketchbooks and things, put them on the projector, and then use them to fill up the canvases that we were working on so we could draw it bigger and not have to reproduce it just by hand and take another 2 hours.
You know, the picture that I have on the wall behind me, it's a digital recreation of a one I did in pencil, but it was part of an art camp project where literally we brought in a small little clipping from a magazine, anything you want to draw, a picture, a magazine, whatever. And we had to do like a half inch by half inch grid on it. And then on a huge poster, we did like a 4 inch by 4 inch grid. We literally only move, like, we draw this grid here, this square to this square, this square to this square. It's literally no different when you project a blown up thing from something smaller, but you took out all the manual labor to do it. Okay, so we're not dipping our quills in ink anymore. We can buy pens at the store. That doesn't mean we're cheating when we write. That's so stupid. Like, there are absolutely inventions we can do. Now, I totally agree with you when it comes to AI art. I think that there are definitely ethical ways that you can create ideas and prompts and things like that, but unfortunately, there are so many, like you said, models right now that are basically just scraping existing pictures and images that exist online, which I think is sucks. I even saw one recently that looked identical to a really famous National Geographic picture, and it was like AI made this based off of a prompt, and that's the picture it chose to kind of base its model off of. And everyone was like, okay, you can't even like you can't even pretend that's not straight up copying. Plus, that's getting a whole, you know what, that's another tangent we should get into next time. But no, I totally agree, because I use Procreate for my art as well, and I have to admit I prefer it over pen and ink now, because I am a mistaker. I make a
Same.
lot of mistakes, I make a lot of experiments, a lot of layers. When I found out you could layer, like, that was a huge deal for me. So I'm gonna get back onto the brief here real quick. You said in the past, and because I've heard you say this before, that your craft comes through your art. Can you elaborate on that more, and maybe even a little bit more on the praxis of your craft? Like, what does that look like? I know a lot of us have different, like, themes, maybe, possibly if it's with like deities or traditions. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that looks like?
For sure. Actually, I'm going to start with a fun little comparison. I'm going to assume you both have seen American Horror Story Coven before.
Yes, definitely.
Obviously, I feel like we all have several
7 or 10 times.
times. But
I
yeah.
was just thinking, I was like, wow, it's been 10 years since that came out.
Yep.
Right?
I watch it at least like twice a year at this
Yeah.
point. But anyway, if I had to compare like the way I feel about my craft to like a character in that season, it would be Cordelia in the first half of the Coven season, which to explain further, it is like I have a lot of little bits of knowledge. I love learning things. I love talking about it with people. But when I actually like sit down and try and do things, I lose all confidence in myself. And maybe sometimes something will turn out the way that I want it to. And I'll be like, oh, it actually works. And then the next day I'll be like, I can't do this. I don't know why I'm even trying to do this. But that's really how my craft is going at this point. But I feel so much more connected to things when I get to make art and sort of express myself in that way. I don't know if that makes much sense, but the way that I create things, not so much maybe professionally for actual paid gigs, but when I just make art for myself at home just randomly, and I might post some of them on Instagram, that is when I feel the most connected to something outside of me, which I feel like is the whole reason that I came into a sort of magical practice or witchcraft in itself, is just a means for me to try and connect to, whether it be nature, spirit, something just outside of myself, something that's a little more fantastical than just what's going on right here. Just to know that something else is happening somewhere beyond right here is kind of enough for me. So that's kind of what I do basically in my craft, is I'll sit down and do like little meditative rituals. I might light candles, I'll read cards, I'll speak to spirit. And often some of the things that I do end up drawing come from dreams that I've had. I have a list of dreams on my phone. I could scroll for probably an entire minute with all the things that I've dreamt since I've started like taking my practices a little more seriously in the last couple of years, which has been really insane. I do have a dream journal that I need to fill up, but it gets too daunting just looking at all the notes that I take on my phone. But I do feel like in a way I am, the art comes first and the craft comes second, because a lot of the things that I express through like dreaming and what I like to create is what informs the way that I practice and the way I like to connect with certain spirits or things in nature. If I can go on another tangent really quick, I'm sure you, since you both follow me on Instagram, you know I draw a lot and have a lot of things related to birds. And that is mostly because when, first of all, when I was younger, if we're going way back, I had the strangest obsession with birds. I don't know why. I wanted to be an ornithologist for a couple years. Then, as I entered middle school, high school, college, I forgot all about that. Hadn't really thought about birds for ages. And then, when I started sitting down and doing more serious witchcraft practices, speaking with spirit, lighting candles, making offerings, I didn't really know what I was speaking to. I was just putting it out there because I was just really starting out. I was like walking to work one day, and all of a sudden, there was a hawk just sitting on a light post next to me. I'd never seen a hawk before in real life, ever before. And I was just looking at him, and I was like, oh, that's cool. I took a picture and I kept walking. And then for weeks after that, after I would do rituals and things at my desk, we would be out and about, and a hawk would fly over top of the car. Or there was once where we were sitting in a drive-through at like a fast food restaurant. I think it was in the fall sometime. It was almost a cinematic moment. I was watching a leaf blow past the car, and I looked up where it went past the tree line, and there was a hawk sitting right there. And I was like, okay, this is getting weird. And so at one point, one day, I was doing a ritual in the morning. It was a nice day out. I just wanted to sit and meditate for a while. I finished, and then I wasn't planning on going anywhere, but I got this random flash in my head that I needed to take a walk to the cemetery because I lived a few blocks away from the big local gated cemetery. So I was like, okay, fine. So I put my jacket on, I went out, I was walking with my headphones in, not really paying attention to anything. And I was rounding the corner of the cemetery, and I looked in, and there was a tree in one of the farthest corners, and there were two really familiar shapes just sitting on the lowest branch in the tree. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. So I started like suburban mom power walking to the gate to get into the cemetery, rounded the corner, made my way up to the tree, looked up, and on the lowest branch, like right there, were just two hawks just staring right down at me. I was like, holy shit. I talked to them for a second. They just looked at me, and I was just like, thanks so much for, I guess, letting me know that you're here so I can come see you. And they looked at me for a second, flew up, circled around for about 10 seconds, and then just took off onto the other side of town. And I was like, holy shit. I don't know what's happening with birds, but they are such a big part of my practice now. I like to honor them in my artwork a lot. I make a lot of like winged creatures or bird-inspired creatures. And I guess in sort of a, how do I want to say it, like a metaphorical sense, I know everyone has different takes on different elements and how they play into like real life situations, but for me, I suppose that birds in a way represent creativity and communication, the things that I really need to pay attention to and that I use a lot in making illustrations, both for myself and in a professional capacity. I feel like that birds are a really good sort of spiritual guide to work with in that way, especially like the sharp-eyed ones like hawks, owls, things of that nature. And so much of what I do is kind of, I don't know, I guess sharp or nocturnal things in that vein. So I guess working with these sort of animal spirits and their archetypes really helps me hone in on what I want to produce in my art and in my practice. That was really long-winded. I hope that makes sense.
No, it does. I love that you mentioned that because in my practice, the familiar crow connects with the sky and air, the element of air, and that whole thing is about communication, divining, communication between spirits above and below. There's like a whole aspect of what I think of as like aviary spirits as being those great communicators. They can go great distances. They can literally fly. That's should be obvious.
Not all birds.
Not all
Not all
birds.
birds.
That's true. There's always the magnanimous penguin, or as what's his name likes to say, pingwing. But I love that you mentioned Cordelia at the beginning because I was just imagining a Myrtle Snow just being like, "Well, there's always Cordelia's conjured coriander condiments," as she's
Absolutely. She's
playing
the
the
voice. She
theremin.
is the voice in my head every other day, where I'm like, I should just probably do something else.
I do
Well,
love
there's
Myrtle
always.
Snow.
I
Oh,
love
my darling
Myrtles.
dear, I've been buying in bulk from Korea for ages.
Yes, darling. No, she's my absolute favorite. And there is something I feel about all of those characters that I think many practitioners love because there's someone they identify with. And I mean, there's a lot of stuff about that show that obviously has nothing to do with real magic and witchcraft
Yes.
whatsoever. But I think that's also kind of one of the reasons why we fucking love it. Because there are sometimes things that, you know, but then there are some things that are just so absolutely rudimentary, like straight up spitting in someone's beverage and then giving it to them so you can not. Like it's the simplest thing ever, but it's something about getting a piece of you inside of them so then you can be the earworm in their ear telling them what to do and how to do it. I think that there's something so fascinating about that. And we all kind of just love it a little bit, even though Fiona's not quite the good guy.
I love her,
That's
icon.
also what I was gonna say. That's also why we love her, is
That's
because she's
exactly.
not the good
We love of there's something about female villains are better anyways, honestly. Let's be real here. So I'm curious. You created an oracle deck. It's called Witches Through History. I got some myself. I actually ordered it and then you reached out to send it to me. So I got the one that you sent me and then the one that I ordered I gave to my sister for Christmas
Okay,
and
that's
she
lovely.
oh, she loves it. She literally opened it immediately because at first she thought it was like, you know, it's just some cards and maybe like a flip book, but the book is actually pretty substantial. Like the book is like the cards are wonderful and your art is fantastic. The book is super, super full of information. Can you tell us a little bit more about creating it or about the book itself? Like, what is it? Tell us about it.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's funny that you mention it in that way, because when we were starting the project, me and the team that I was working with, it was just going to be a book. That's what I went in with the pitch. I just wanted it to be a book, and that's all it was going to be. But as we were having talks and we were talking about like my Instagram presence, things of that nature, I was like, well, I do have so many people saying all the time, you should make a card deck, you should do a tarot deck, you should design cards. So they were like, would you want to just add on an oracle deck to accompany the book? And I said, sure, that sounds really cool to me, actually. I have been getting a lot of messages after the fact that people are like, could you make like an expansion to it? Like, it would be great if there were more cards. And I was like, I know, but we could only put so many in the package that we were trying to make. But I'm hoping that, just to go on a tangent about the cards real quick, I'm hoping
Please.
that even though it's only 25, I really tried to compartmentalize them in such a way that they did make sense in such a small capacity of just 25 cards. I tried to base them elementally based on what each different element, at least to me, sort of represented. I went and I sat down in a cafe one day, ages ago, and I was just thinking about things that were in the book, things that I thought would be significant to represent what I wanted to portray in the cards. And I just sat down and wrote whatever sort of little blurb came to me for each of them, just intuitively. And then that's what they became in the book. So I hope that people can use them in their practice in some capacity, or even if it's just to like use them as like witchcraft flashcards, that's fine with me too. Because I did try to include little bits of like history or metaphor that relate to magical practices on them. But the book itself, yeah, that was the bulk of the project. I have been happy to see that when people are receiving it and opening it, they seem to be so excited that there is a full book inside, because they think that it's an oracle deck with just a guidebook. But the guide to the cards is just the very end of the book, and the rest of it is full of actual historical information and maybe a little bit of my own craft mixed in, not to an exponential degree, but just little bits and pieces. But this is something that I'm just really honored and excited that I got to make, because it was a theme and a genre that has inspired my artwork for so long. It's what kickstarted all the things I wanted to do when I was a kid. So when I pitched it and they accepted it, I was just ecstatic. I don't really know what else to say, but and the research process was really fun. I really enjoyed writing all through when I was in school. I hadn't really gotten to do it much up until this point when they were like, hey, you write pretty well when you're like sending emails or like writing bios for things. Do you just want to write the book yourself? Because we were originally going to have someone else write it. It was just my idea for the themes and the imagery, but they enjoyed the way I was writing. So they had faith enough in me to write the entire book. And I hope it comes across like I've done my research because I did quite a shit ton of research to make it.
No, it's very, very clear. And so, like, for our listeners, if you haven't seen this, it really goes into like a huge deep dive of the history of like documented, well-known, accused, convicted, and then also folkloric witches. You've got, you know, you've got some things in there about, you know, Hecate. Like, so there's like a collection of icons throughout history that have fed into what it means to be a witch. Iconic. Like, I think it's just one of those things that, just to kind of go on my own little tangent just for a second, like, I
Go ahead.
came into witchcraft with this idea of loving storybook witches, but understanding that that wasn't the truth. You know, it was all about that it was actually Wicca, because again, I came into it in the 90s when Wicca was the real witchcraft and it was synonymous. And there was something that I was just like, oh, I love all that, but this is true witchcraft. This is the way it's truly done with the Lord and the Lady and the sabbatic wheel of the year. And I, you know what? I'm happy to just have this because then I can be close to the thing in the storybook that inspires me so much. And then as I got older, like I started to understand that there are a lot of different traditions. A lot of them have different histories. A lot of them have different beliefs, dogmas, religions. And in fact, the one that was not, and of course, you know, then I came to the whole conclusion that, oh, wow, you mean this isn't an ancient pre-Christian religion? I've been lied to. So it was one of those really, really cool things that when I started to understand folkloric witchcraft exists, and in fact, a huge portion of real documented folk magic, subversive charms, cunning practitioners, a lot of these things are inspired by stories. Then you go back to early paganism, where the magic was still inspired by the witches in these stories, like Medea and Circe and you know, the torch carrier who was in the underground half the year with Persephone, Hecate. Like, there are a lot of stories that inspire historical and modern craft, and this book really dove into it. So I got really excited to read a bunch of these things. And you said you did a lot of research for it. Can you tell us a little bit about like what that research was like? What was your mode of getting and acquiring this information to put it in this book?
Yeah, for sure. The way I keep ex describing it is like it was like doing a giant thesis research project for school, except I got to do it basically for fun to make this project. So every day waking up and getting to do research on this was just one of the most fun. It was a lot of work, but it was one of the most fun things I've ever done. But thankfully, now that we have the internet, even though I do support libraries, I love books, a big resource for making this book was the fact that a lot of people have taken old transcripts and trial records, pamphlets, things of that nature, and they have transcribed them digitally in sort of online archives, Internet Archive, early English books online. There's a lot of them listed in the back of the book for what I used to do the actual research. So it was referring to a lot of those, sort of sifting through the weird language that a lot of them use to try and say what I needed to say in the book to get people to understand what was going on. I also use a lot of modern sources. I use a lot of websites, sort of witchcraft websites, blogs, things of that nature. A few of my own books that I just have here at home on the Salem Witch Trials, or I have a lot of big, thick, illustrated, almost like scholarly books about occultism, witchcraft, old artwork, things of that nature. So it was a smattering of everything, but I think, yeah, the biggest resource that I used was old mythologies and transcripts of these actual trial records, which is what I really wanted to drive home when I was making it, because the whole reason I wanted to do this was to sort of make a project that would be engaging for people just artistically and to look at. Because when I was younger, I loved seeing things of this nature. But I feel like, especially in the witchcraft realm, a lot of the books you would get, especially a while ago, maybe not so much anymore, but they felt too scholarly, I guess, for me. And sometimes that turns people off because they can't read in that way. So I wanted to make something that was historical that people could actually learn from, but was more engaging and simple to like take in and process. if that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does. I'm kind of curious a little bit more too. I want to go into a few of these major players, these characters, these historical witches. Can you share with us a few of the witches that you did some research on that stood out to you? And what about their stories? Are things that are what about their stories really stuck with you?
I will say, doing this research, it was surprising to me. Just, I mean, I knew that there were a lot of fantastical things that were supposedly happening back then, but I didn't realize all the wild things that people were being accused of or that were being reported. So I think if I could say some of my favorite, I don't know if I have a particular favorite witch icon in general, but I do love stories about different types of familiars that people were supposedly interacting with. I don't know why. There's something about a strange, I mean, obviously, if you look at my artwork, it makes sense, but there's something about a strange spiritual being that's like a conglomerate of different things that just fascinates me to no end. Like the story of Agnes Waterhouse and her familiar, I think it's pronounced Satan, but it's spelled like Satan with a TH. But the fact that she was supposed to have a cat who transformed into a toad and then into a dog and also a dog with horns that had a man's face, I was like, that is terrifying and also so magical. And that was one of my favorite things to do research for. And also did a little mini illustration of the familiar in the book at one point, based on an actual, I think it was like an old ink or woodblock illustration that someone did of it. I don't know where it's housed currently, but if you look it up, I think you'll be able to find it. But yeah, I love stories of that nature. I love doing the familiar section in the book just because that's, I don't know why, that's the thing that interests me the most, maybe because I have such strange interactions with birds, and I just love learning about different animal associations and the way that spirits interact with people. If I had to say one of the most tragic stories in the book that really hit me was the story of, what was her name? Janet Horn, I believe. She's one of the last witch profiles listed because it was just such a sad story because apparently she had dementia and didn't actually know what was happening to her because she was being accused of transforming her daughter into a horse, and that was supposedly why her daughter had like clubbed hands and feet. It was probably just something she had since birth, but she was accused of terrible things. They were jailed and they were to be put to death the next day. Somehow her daughter escaped, but she was brought to the stake, covered in oil, paraded through town in a barrel, supposedly didn't know it was happening because she had dementia, was warming her hands on the fire, and she died. And when I was writing this section, I had like a tear in my eye because it was just so tragic. I do think there is a small memorial to her on a stone somewhere in Scotland, close to nearby where she passed. But yeah, I wanted to both drive home the fact that some of these stories are very mystical, fantastical, strange, weird, but a lot of them are also really tragic. And there is a big intermingling of those two things in a lot of magical practices that I wanted people to be aware of by the end of the book.
It is really interesting that you bring that up because I think too, like that's why so many of us, I think, drive home like witchcraft, or at least why I drive home, that witchcraft is a sociopolitical accusation that has very important connotations and very real consequences, for that. And I was wondering if you do you have this one's really good. I have a client when I did hair gave it to me, and it's the Encyclopedia of Witches and Witchcraft, and it's by I can't see the full name, but it's Guiley, and it's the second edition, and I think it was published in like maybe the early 2000s, late 90s, but it's like so it's a pretty it's not super thick. I have thicker, but it's pretty thick, and it's a really good one. It's a pretty short blurbs, but it goes through a lot of documentation on witches, also like witchcraft things and historical events, but it also has a lot of like modern it has like a little bit of everything. I love it. It's a really good resource book. I love parsing through it sometimes.
I don't think I know what that is, to be honest, which surprises me. So I need to look it up after we're done
Yeah,
here.
it's really good. They have like a lot of bits and bobs of random people, but they have so many people from the 1960s and like onward as well. But they also cover like the Ludan possession and so many bunch of little things in there. It's a really good little resource to have around.
Absolutely. I love hearing about the different little libraries that especially other like magical practitioners have. It's so funny because when I think about my own library, so much of it is related more so to the art side of things than it is to the witchcraft side of things, because that is also what sort of enhances and feeds into the craft that I do. Because I have so many books on mythology, the mythology of witches, folklore, things of that nature. I don't have a lot of actual books on craft per se, but I think it's just as much of a great resource to have historical and mythological books that inform your practice, along with actual sort of scholarly firsthand accounts of different people's practices.
You know, it's really interesting. You were talking about the way that many of these stories are actually really tragic. We have the documentation of a massive amount of people who were persecuted because they were, you know, being accused of witchcraft. And it's maybe this is like me on my little low pedestal soapbox here for a second, but I feel like when it comes to the internet, because all of us, you know, have some sort of like connection to social media and the internet, many times, when it comes to discussing any sort of matter, honestly, whatsoever, when someone has an opinion on it, or maybe when the pendulum has swung just a little too far, I feel like sometimes the collective zeitgeist swings back just a way too far the other direction. And I remember seeing this thing a while ago where there was like a swing all about people professing that, like, we have to stop talking about these quote unquote burning times. These burning times never happened. If I read a book when someone talks about the burning times, I immediately put it down. And I'm just like, well, hold on one second. It's one thing to recognize that no, millions upon millions of actively practicing witches were not burnt at the stake, especially in America. Yes, we can absolutely agree with that statement. But I don't think, and this is where I think the baby got thrown out with the bathwater, when you throw away the entirety of the burning times, you also throw away the massive amounts of persecution and actual people who were burnt for the accusation of witchcraft. And sometimes they were herbalists. Sometimes they practiced a mix of religion. Sometimes they were hung because the city didn't trust them anymore. And they were like the local cunning person. Something went wrong. Something didn't go the right way. Someone had, you know, an earworm in their ear, you know, Fiona must have spat in their water. But like, people died. A lot of people died being on the end of that accusatory finger. And I think the way that the internet sometimes erases the existence of the quote unquote burning times does away with the fact that they did die, a lot of people. And one of the reasons why I always say that witchcraft is political is because we don't, for the most part, die anymore. The government cannot persecute us for the conversation we are having right now. You know, they can't take away our books. We can write and publish openly. We can write and publish openly about curses that literally kill people. Like we live in a time that we have to recognize that at one point, just the idea of laughing about it could have put you on the end of a noose. So when we talk about and learn about a lot of these historic figures, some of them have mysterious folkloric ends. Some of them we have no documentation about whatsoever. And some of them we have the records that showed that they died, they were burnt, they were hung, or they were pressed to death. You know, like a lot of people had some serious tragedies. And one of the things that I think is my responsibility. I'm not going to put this because I'm not a virtue signaler. I'm not going to put this on anyone else, but one of my responsibilities as a modern practicing witch is to recognize the political nature in which I stand taking on that identity and to know about them, to know their histories, to understand the people who died so I could stand here freely. I feel like your book does a really, really good job letting me know about some of these people who I may never have heard of before. I felt like it was more than just oracle cards we were talking about before. These are people. Many of them existed, and many of them before the internet, we did not have instant access to that we can look up now. So having them on a card, like I just posted this week about Agnes, I believe Agnes Waterhouse, and I have a few more like about Alison Devis
I don't
device.
know how to say her. I think it's device. It could be
Yes,
Devis. They have the weirdest names,
it could be
but
either or. One of the original Old Mother Redcaps who ended up, I think there's Mother Shipton. There's a lot of these people that we have documentation of, and it's so funny to think the records we have on them kind of add to this mysteriousness. We don't know how true and honest that some of them are. Like, we know this person was born, we know that they may lived in a cave, but they also have stories of people from the village who went to them for magic. They were passed down orally. Things have been added to them. It's kind of like a lot of these Grimm's fairy tales. They may have started with, you know, an actual story, but as it got told by different people, things were added, things were changed, words got added to it. And I feel like they kind of take on these mystical presences that we, when we talk about our ancestors, our witch ancestors, these are them. Like, these are those spirits that we're calling on sometimes. So I take it as a personal responsibility to know about them.
For sure. One of the things that I like that you sort of drive home a lot, both online and just in the podcast in general, is that the fantastical stories, especially, not just the tragic bits, but like the mystery, the magic, the pomp and circumstance of it all, can still be a part of your craft today. And imagination can absolutely be a pivotal part of your magical practice, just because it seems like a wild story or it's something that's living in your head that you may not have seeing yourself, or maybe you haven't actually experienced happening. It doesn't mean it's not an important part of what you do or the story that you're creating or the craft that you're doing. That's why I think folklore and mythology is such a pivotal part of any magical practice, really. It's because even though a lot of it is strange and weird, it's also based in a lot of experiences that people have had all those ages ago and may have gotten changed and built upon over the years, but there is a history behind it that is really important to just have in your backlog, I think.
I fully agree. And I think that recognizing that, and also too, it can really help you magically, but like recognizing the people who have come before you. And some of these people get adopted into craft lineages. People get a lot of people who are like witch ancestors are very important to some traditions, where it's like, okay, this person did live a very magical life, and it usually incorporates the tragic backstory or the mythology around them. Some of them were real people, some of them are questionably real people, or thoughts of who these real people might be, legends, etc., etc., and they get utilized magically in a craft space. So I think it's really cool to look back on the people who have come before us and recognize, like, this is what has, and especially speaking from a place, at least in America, in the West for the most part, like, there is a level of recognition that we have to have that, like, we can have this podcast, we can have this talk, and that's beneficial. And it still isn't quite like that everywhere, and there's a struggle that I have with the reasons for all of these things, everywhere, everything all at once. But yeah, I really appreciate the work that you've been doing in that space.
You're speaking to me.
Yes, yeah, okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, I appreciate
Actually,
it.
I was talking to me.
I was just like, really, oh, Marshall, he loves you. No, thank you, I really appreciate that. And there is a section sort of towards the end of the book where I talk about, like, ongoing witch trials and witch, quote-unquote, killings and things. That was a harder section to write. It's kind of short, but it was just an odd thing to speak about, especially because a lot of these things are still happening simply because they are happening in less developed parts of the world, so they don't really have maybe the availability of the internet or some of the modern interpretations or scientific reasoning for some things that are happening. So they're still almost living in a bygone era where they're blaming different people for these tragic but natural things that are occurring. And I'm hoping someday we won't have to deal with that anymore, but it's still a really big issue in different parts of the world, and that I'm glad I got to incorporate little bits and pieces of that near the end of the book, just so people know that it's still an ongoing thing. Just because we may live in like a Western society and anyone can claim they're a witch and buy crystals and do whatever the hell they want, there are people that are still having real life awful repercussions because of these past stories and fears that people have had, and it hasn't ended yet.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'm thinking about the art that you put out, that you create. This is your first like major publication where it's the majority of your art, but you've also had your art was the cover of Icelandic Folk Magic
Oh
for yes. And I know you've illustrated, you've done some other illustrations as well, haven't you?
yeah, I've done bits and bobs here and there. I would like to do more for more like magic practitioners if anyone wants to hire me. I had a really great time doing that for Albert. I think it was such a cool project to work on. I get a little giddy every time I see people posting the book, and I'm like, I made that drawing. It's so strange, and it's cool to be an aspect of someone else's practice through my art, which is that's all I ever want to do, really, is that if I can enrich someone's life or help them discover something about themselves just through the things I create. Some of my favorite comments that I get, even though I create weird shit all the time just from my head, I'll get comments every so often where people are like, this is exactly the way that I view the world. This resonates so much with like a certain spirit or deity that I like to work with, and that warms my heart because it's a connection that I guess you only get in a certain sphere with people when you're making artwork of this type. I don't know where I'm going with this, but I think you understand what I'm saying.
No, I totally understand. And you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about you specifically as an artist, and I talked earlier before about how your craft comes through your art. And I like you that you even mentioned before too that sometimes the art comes first and it inspires the actual ritual, the rite, the spellcraft, or maybe the spirit communication afterwards. I feel like there are muses all around us or within us, especially as you know, spirit workers or however you want to identify as a witch. There are times when I'm writing or drawing that I feel like there is something coming through, and sometimes only afterward I really truly understand what it is. And I think back at the way so many artists, specifically in maybe not necessarily in the witch community, but have affected occultists for years and sometimes centuries to come. Like I think a lot about like John Waterhouse's paintings. Like I have no idea or whether or not he was a practitioner of any kind whatsoever, but he was obviously deeply inspired by the occult. He was deeply inspired by witches, witchcraft, spirit flight. He has all of these creations of witches flying to Sabbaths, a coven of witches meeting with, you know, that the folkloric to devil, like almost like a mixture of a Baphomet caped being. We have another one. I actually have it hanging in my bathroom of a witch casting a circle. She's got like a snake around her neck, and there's like a frog watching and crows watching. These are things that are over, I think they're from like the early 1800s, and they're still, I mean, they're on my walls, so obviously they still affect us. And then we have like Austin Osman Spare, like one of the premier well-known occultists who ended up starting what became, you know, sigil crafting, which chaos magic picked up and went to town with that we all know of now. Like some of his art to this day is still so haunting, the way he would put together these crazy visions of like these celestial spirits and beings. I'm looking at some of these right now. It's these horrifyingly bizarre conglomerations of half man, half animal, and then you see the way that he's applied these into his own spirituality. And it's still very mysterious because we don't understand all of them, but they're still documented. We can look them up if you're listening. Definitely look up Austin Osman Spare's art as well. It's really, really cool. And then, you know, we also have Rosalie Norton, the Australian witch. I'm not sure if you got to see her documentary, but there was a really, really cool way in which she created these mystical and diabolical looking paintings. And now there's a whole documentary talking about this like crazy eccentric witch all the way out of Australia who created magic through her art. And so when you said that, I thought about the way we as modern practitioners today can put our magic through, I know I put it through my writing a lot, and you put it through your art a lot. And I don't know what you do, Austin, but whatever.
Don't worry, it's not important.
It's not important. You know what? All
You were so on one too. It was really good.
thank you. Yeah, you put it in your effigies and parfums. It all comes through. I feel like we're kind of coming to this really amazing golden age of magical practices where it doesn't all look like the wheel of the year anymore. It doesn't all look like happy Imbolc, everyone. Like that's beautiful. I love it. I said it myself on Imbolc, right? But there is a inspiration that it comes through more than just how-to books with just 101 books. And I think, the girls who get it because we can see it come through the art. We can see it come through the story. We can see it come through the spirit that wants to tell us what is it. Does that make
Absolutely. And
sense?
yeah, for
Okay,
sure.
good.
And to piggyback off of that a little bit, I feel like obviously so much of the creative process, just as like an artist, a writer, someone who makes tools or perfumes the way Austin does, but especially if you're thinking about like the flow state that people get into all the time. My
Yes.
fiance is constantly harping on me about it because when I get something in my head that I need to let out, I will sit on the couch for hours at a time. I won't look up. I won't eat. I won't go to the bathroom. I just sit there and I make it and it's just coming out. I don't even really know what I'm making sometimes. I'm just drawing until it takes shape and I'm done. And I'm like, oh, well, this is fucking weird, but that's what needed to come out. And then by the end of it, I'm sweating. I'm hungry. I have to go to the bathroom. But it is such a strange feeling of being able to sit down and enter such a state where you do feel like something else just is communicating that needs to express itself. And whatever happens at the end of that, it's just what it is. There are times sometimes where I'll make a piece. And I'll be like, oh, I actually have a really strange connection to this. And I'll take it up like to my altar upstairs, like on my iPad, just sit it down and be like, I made this for you, I guess, because this is what you wanted me to make. Or if I do an image of Hecate, because she's also really inspiring to me, I'll sometimes take the images that I make of her and set them up on my altar as like an offering. I feel like artwork and crafts and tools can be such a really interesting way to honor spirits or archetypes that people are working with, aside from just like leaving out wine or milk or food offerings. I think the act of crafting something is a really important process when you're doing magic.
I'm curious, when you make, do you mind if I ask about your effigies real quick?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Do you find that when you are creating some of these effigies, do you ever find that it comes like this flow state similar to what Dev was talking about?
So it depends on what I'm making and the need for making them, because I usually make them as a trade for something. So if you get XYZ done for me, I'll make XYZ for you. So one of them being a demon that I can't remember the name of.
That's
That's
probably on
problematic.
purpose.
Yeah,
That's on
probably.
purpose.
No, I made
Rumble, what?
This Rumpel foreskin.
I haven't heard that one before.
a favorite one of mine, and was a trade-off for that very reason. And it was like very insistent on like painting the bottoms of the shoes red, like Louboutins, and the whole costuming of the thing was supposed to be, it was obviously like inspired from text that is written about this particular demon, and it has like the head of a jaguar or a leopard or a lion in some cases, and is usually a spirit that will incite lust in people and get them to take their clothes off and things like that. But when I created this fetish for this demon, it was very insistent that I painted like the bottom of the shoes red. And so with that, when I did do that, then I had this like incredible like download of a formula for poppers. And it was very much like, do X, Y, and Z to this poppers formula, and then I will like be basically like I will empower this working. And so I did, and I mean it was a really good time. That's when I made the those poppers, that popper formula that I had sloughed off to a bunch of people. So, and I will be making more at some point in time. They were fragrance, like you could smell like perfume. They were perfumed poppers, and it was a really, really interesting time. But yeah. So to answer your question, it can be flow state. Sometimes it's a mixture of like, okay, this, and this has to be in there. Sometimes it's based off spirit request. Yeah, there's different ways that I go about it, depending on the purpose for the spirit.
I was just curious because I know sometimes you'll show as you're building these effigies in like your private, like close circle groups, and sometimes you'll show them at the very end when they're all done. So I was curious and I wanted to ask before just asking on air. We can always
Yeah.
edit it out, but
No, I appreciate it. Thank you for
of
asking.
course. And I feel like that's kind of what I'm talking about, that I talk about UPG a lot, or personal gnosis, a lot, because a huge portion of my craft is personal gnosis. And I think we've really, as a collective, occultist community, we have gotten to a gorgeous place of embracing unverified personal gnosis, especially for the singular. And the way that we're sharing it more now, I feel like, has become so much more visible. And I feel like it's conversations like these that I think a lot of new practitioners who are trying to understand witchcraft are so hungry for how to kind of be told what the next steps are. What, how do I get in, I get started? Like, who are my deities? How do I know if they're reaching out to me? Like, they're hungry for these questions. And it's conversations like these where we're talking about, actually, no deity reached out to me. I had this dream of this hawk. I found a, you know, I followed this hawk into a cemetery. Or sorry, it was a hawk, wasn't it? Two hawks, yes. Or I wanted to make a fetish for this demon, and I kept getting this feeling it was telling me it wanted red bottom shoes. It wanted red bottom shoes. Like, these are very individually experienced things that aren't really told to us in any modern witchcraft for modern girly. Like, I want more people to listen to conversations from modern practitioners and witches like this, because they're so personal, and it kind of puts it back on the new practitioner to build those bonds, to feel a little bit more confident in creating those pieces of art, to write their own stories, to kind of explore more the unexplored territories of their spirituality, instead of only stepping in the footsteps of what has been written by so many authors already. I think that that's really, really cool, and I hope listeners feel inspired and more confident to do that.
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of the time, I mean, I myself, my craft isn't really complicated, and I have not been doing it for as many years as a lot of other people have, probably like you too, for example. But I feel like a lot of people who are sort of just starting out in a magical path seem to have this notion that, not that it is simple, but that it's an extremely complicated thing, and you have to do this specific thing at this certain time, or you have to reach out to this deity or this spirit in this particular way. And I feel like it doesn't really happen like that at all, because everyone is, like you said, very individual. Everyone's practice, everyone's experiences are extremely personal to them. And it can be like I said, something as simple as just like noticing a certain bird that's appearing all the time, or having a random dream after doing a working. If I can go on another tangent, I never really thought that I would be someone that worked with any sort of like deity types of spirits, because I came out of Catholicism into a magical practice, and I was like, I'm kind of over God and gods and deities. I just want to do what I want to do and not really worry about it. But after a while, for some reason, I don't know why, I never really knew at the beginning who Hecate was, even though in the witchcraft circle, she's talked about all the time nowadays, and she made a prominent appearance in the Sabrina show as well. But I was just doing different research for artwork and things of that nature, and things just kept happening that I was paying attention to, and I was like, maybe I should try reaching out to her sort of energy current, because I feel like she embodies so many different things, that there's different pinpoints to sort of attach yourself to. Like, some people work with her for necromantic purposes. Other people might work with her to open doors as a key keeper, or to guide them with her torch-bearingness. But there were just so many little things that were happening. Like, also to relate it back to animals, one day I was just walking home from work, and there was a random snake that was winding in front of me, and it went right into the cemetery as I was crossing. And then I was having other random dreams about things that I didn't really understand until I was looking them up. And I was like, oh, well, this relates back to this sort of archetypal energy current after I looked it up. So I was like, maybe I should just start working with Hecate and her energies. So I would get little statues, I would make artwork pertaining to her, just offer it up to her. And I feel like, in a sense, that came at such a really pivotal time, because at the point at which I started making this project, which is through history, was also the point at which the pandemic was sort of happening in its early stages. And also, I didn't really have a regular job because everyone was laid off, let go, and I was thinking about quitting that anyway. So I was at a crossroads in life, and then I was speaking to the lady of Crossroads herself just for a little bit of help. And I think that really helped me find my footing and really get onto the path that I'm on now. So really, I guess, in a sense, I see Hecate almost as like a muse sort of figure. I mean, she can be a lot darker than that, but so much of the stuff that I make is dark, and I really find beauty in the strange and darker aspects of things, the things that are sort of misunderstood and maligned. So I think in a sense, through her sort of energy path is the way that I just lost my train of thought. It's the way that I produce art and the way that I practice the things that I do now.
I can totally see the way it comes through because you post a lot of like as you're creating things. I've noticed in some of your stories, like you'll have sometimes different backgrounds, or you'll just be like, hey, I've updated something. And I think that's actually really, really cool. You'll take old art that you've done, specifically like of Hecate, and then you'll update it to be some. It's almost feeling like maybe this is just me. It's almost feeling like you're kind of experiencing a little bit of a shift in your perception or relationship, and that must come through in the art as well.
Oh, for sure. And I do that just for so many different artworks. Sometimes it's just because I think it needs to look different. Sometimes it's because maybe I'll see something or just I'll get a download, I suppose, in my head that it needs to look a different way. It's usually some type of creature that I've already drawn, and I'll be like, oh, this face isn't right. I need to go change it. And then I'll repost it. There's a certain image. You might know what I'm talking about. It's like an imp creature. It has wings and like little horns, but it had a completely different, almost like monkey-esque face when I first drew it. And then, like years later, I was like, "This face isn't correct." And then I just changed it, and now it has almost like a, almost a mask type face, and that's where it's been sitting for a while. I might change it again at some point, but for some reason, that one really spoke to me, and I needed to shift it around about 10 different times. But I really like when things like that happen because, one, it can make the artwork look better and more interesting, and two, if it is coming from somewhere outside of myself, then obviously that is something that needed to happen, and maybe it is more preferable to whatever thing I have made this for.
Absolutely, I fully agree. Like it's like, oh, things tell you. It's like, oh no, that isn't quite right. Or you know, also allowing artistically as well as spiritually for like we are allowed to change, we're allowed to grow. I think that, and we're allowed to change things that we are doing, and have different opinions. Yeah, I don't know if anyone told you. I know that like the online sphere has a bad habit of being like, oh, well, here's like some inconsistencies in your story. And it's like, well, aren't not inconsistencies in the story as a whole, but it's like, oh, but last month you were doing something different. It's like, I am allowed to develop.
Evolve,
I hate to tell you, yeah, I'm allowed to not be the same person I was a year ago. But yeah.
That is a wild concept to a lot of people,
It
but
is, yeah.
you're absolutely right. And I just feel that a lot, not even from other people saying it, but just personally, just artistically, I suppose, because I shift between so many different styles of artwork all the time, but I feel like they all have a different place for each different thing that I'm creating. Usually when I'm doing something that feels more personal or like connected to a certain spirit I have in my head or my crafts, it is in a sort of specific, maybe more painterly or like graphite pencil drawn kind of style. But I have so many other things that I use for professional projects and different side projects. So I think it's important to shift paths as you see fit. That used to be something I was really self-conscious about, but we're humans, we like different things, we connect to different things every other day. So I don't think people should be afraid to shift things around, whether that's artistically, lifestyle wise, or in your magical practice. If something doesn't feel like it's working at this point, come back to it later, try something different. It might work out better than you think it will.
And when it comes to a magical practice, especially when it comes to spirit relationships, like if we're talking about art and maybe spirit revealing itself through art, or in any way, shape, or form, honestly, I had, and I'll bring it back to this for a second, but there is a level of recognizing that what comes to you sometimes is coming to you for where you are at the moment. And as you evolve, more comes with that evolution. When I was taking Jason Miller's Hecate class, I don't, and I won't give too many details away because of his proprietary information. But part of the way that the lessons were conducted, where you got little bits of information that expanded over time. But if he had told us that last lesson somewhere in the middle, it would have made no sense because you had to have all those pieces of the puzzle come together gradually and exposed to it so you could understand how it got to that end piece. And I feel like a lot of times when it comes to spirit relationship, when it comes to our own practices, it's like that as well. Sometimes it starts with a little bit of information. That information has to sit in your psyche somewhere for you to understand it, to get to know it. It's an introduction. It's a coffee date. But the next is the dinner date. And then after that comes the sex. It grows and grows. Like, and that relationship changes and evolves too. I think we see that in our practices. I think that a lot of new practitioners, and maybe even evolved practitioners who are listening today, can totally recognize that their craft does not look the same now as it did, say, a few years ago, or honestly, even 10 weeks ago. Sometimes there are things that evolve and change. And I noticed that when you kind of made some of those adjustments in your art, and I thought it reminded me of that feeling.
For sure. And I think it's a very important thing to keep in mind that change is a good thing. And it's not something to necessarily be afraid of all the time, even though I'm hard on myself a lot whenever I change something, either artistically or in my practice. Especially right now, I feel like I'm at another, like, I don't know, a crossroads, so to speak. I don't really know which direction I'm going in. I know the type of artwork that I want to make, but I'm in the very early stages of another book idea. I don't really know what the next stage of my magical practice is. I feel a little stagnant right now, but making different types of artwork, especially some of the stuff I've been posting in the last couple of days, is really helping me to sort of connect to the things that I am inspired by a lot more. So yeah, I don't, you just need to accept change as it comes. Don't be afraid to just be in a slump for a bit and try something different.
Well, before we go, I would love for you to tell our listeners where they can find you, if you have any final words you'd like to say before you head out, and if there are any projects you'd like to share with our listeners and us.
For sure. Well, thank you for having me on, first of all, for having me talk about the book and my practice. This has been really, really enlightening, and I'm so glad I got to do this today.
Me too.
But you can find me on Instagram. I post on there a lot at Dev Forst, like we said earlier. I do have a website. I need to update it a little more frequently, but that's devinforstillustration.com. You can get Witches Through History, the book and Oracle deck, wherever books are sold online, Barnes and Noble. You can get it from the Rizzoli link in most of my bios on my social media. And currently, I guess I can sort of mention the next project I have going on. Not too much. I'm in the very early stages, but I will say it is very mythological, folkloric, and it will be a lot darker and more terrifying than this project is. So I'm really excited that I get to start working on
I'm
that.
excited too. That's awesome. You've been listening to Southern Bramble, a podcast of Crooked Ways. I'm Marshall, the Witch of Southern Light. You can find me on TikTok, on Threads, on Instagram at Witch of Southern Light, all one word. Please buy my book, Cunning Words, A Grimoire of Tales and Magic, sold and independently published on Amazon. If you are anti-Amazon, that's totally okay. You can find the black and white version at barnesandnoble.com. And if you are a metaphysical or a cult or a shop that would like to sell my book, please do. I would love it if you could. It's available in the Ingram Spark catalog. I think that's everything. I do have an Etsy shop that has great PDFs and spells directly from my book. They're pretty cheap. You can download them immediately and print them out, as well as a Redbubble shop with a lot of my art on it that you can get ordered. Rephrase, a Redbubble shop that has my art that you can get printed on a bunch of different merchandise.
And I'm Austin Bain X Bramble on Instagram. Devin, what about you?
I don't know if there's anything else I have to say. This has been so much fun, and I'm so glad I got to talk to you guys. I feel like I don't get to talk about these things enough to people, especially because I don't post a lot of like magical practices and so forth on my social media. It usually comes through in my artwork, but this has been really enjoyable. So thank you guys for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you so much for being here. It's been truly an honor to talk to the artist, because I've truly fallen in love with your art. I think it's really, really cool, and I hope everyone goes and follows you immediately after this episode is over.
Thank you so much.
At this point in time, we would love to thank our tier 3 supporters from our Patreon by name: Jason, Nico, Colby, Callie, Johnny, Jameson, Jennifer, Cindy, the Witch of Patapsco Forest, John, Giles, Jennifer, Shauna, the Modern Babylon, V, Lisa, Ariella, Keith, Jens, Addity, Tracy, Timothy, Witch Rafa, the Lady Ghost, Seashaw, and of course, Key Archibald. Thank you so much for your support. I truly can't tell you what it means to us to have you be part of the making of our show.